So welcome to, this is our first conference call for RM102, which is Document to Manage Risk in Recreation. And Peter, you'll be doing RM101, but not until February. So, you know, some of the, there'll be a couple of slides that are repetitious, but not really anything because this one digs into a bit more detail to one aspect of the RM101. So we don't have our learning management space or Moodle or learning space up and running today. So I have emailed out the presentation so we can work through some of that together. I'd like to acknowledge that I'm hosting this call from the traditional territory of the Kwamundan First Nation and Tawn Kwachin Council. And as we were talking, we definitely can see climate change happening when there's like, I don't know, 6 or 7 degrees out and thunder and lightning last night. So odd. So as I was just saying, RM102 number 2 designates it as a second learning event in a 3 learning event risk management series. So Spider, you sort of jumped into our advanced learning event. So RM101, as I was saying to Peter, is part of our leadership certificate, and it's sort of an entry level to risk management. And then after we finish this one, we will be doing RM103, which is legal risk. And I believe, Spider, you'll be in that one as well. So you guys have 2 risk management ones back to back, which will flow nicely from one to the other. So when we designed RM102, we were trying to address many of the questions that recreation leaders sort of were raising about paperwork related to programs and services. So that's why we thought we needed a learning event that focused on documentation related to participation, but also documentation related to operations. So it split into 2 weeks based on those 2 topics. So on today's call, I think we've already done our introductions, so there's just 3 of us at the moment. And we're going to go through some of the types of documentation that contribute to safe and enjoyable experiences for people participating in your program and also using your facility. So when we think about participation, it's not just that they come to a program that you're delivering, but you might have a facility that they're a user in, so that counts as well. I've got a number of questions that I just would like to facilitate some conversation today. So just to start, let's just do a round just to get us going and in the process of sharing our ideas. And what I'd like you to do is just say your name and then describe how you react when you hear the word documentation. So I'll start and then we'll go to Spider if he joined the call next, and then to Peter, and then if David jumps in, he can go after that. So as you guys know, I'm Caroline, and my reaction these days when I hear the word documentation, apart from, oh no, how much is it going to cost, is also reading glasses. I never needed glasses until I was in my 50s, and so I'm not quite used to tracking them or passing them around with me. So those are the 2 things that I sort of react when I hear the word documentation. So Spider, how about you? What's your reaction to the word documentation?
I guess generally I hope that sort of ease of completion, that if there's a way it can be streamlined so that it only needs to be entered once. I talk now about, Canada Winter Games, Arctic Winter Games, Western Canada Summer Games. There's a program called GEMS Pro. That's typically the games host uses. But I'm trying to encourage Sport North to create its own registration where an individual just registers once in their lifetime. And maybe the first screen when they go in to get to register again comes up to the screen and they just need to update it. And then that information somehow is transferred to GEMS Pro for a particular games, and it's updated that way. At the moment, every time you want to enter a games, you have to go in and do it again, and another games do it again, and so forth, and then have ways to have access to the information so that if coach registers, then all of a sudden, permission is already been given for them to be emailed for any subsequent coach training that Sport North is doing. So I hope that the technology is there and the permissions are built in so that that documentation becomes very useful to us, but it doesn't become onerous by way of having to do it again and again and again.
Yeah, that's interesting. Hey, I had a number of thoughts going through my mind, like one from the participant level, about, removing some of that burden of filling forms out. But then from the perspective of storing people's personal information, I sort of was going, like, for example, I don't know if you guys saw on CBC News, it found a USB in a pawn shop that was from Yukon Government Health and Social Services and had a bunch of private information on it, right? So sort of that privacy thing is in our forefront or on our minds these days to make sure that we maintain privacy. So I'm not sure if that's maybe why GEMPRO collects things each time and then they remove the data after that person, or at least clean the information from most of the content after the participated. So it'd be interesting to find out what's done with that data behind the scenes, and that might answer or lead you to sort of look into that from different angles.
Or additionally, there becomes minimum standards by which coaches, officials, participants, or chaperones need to provide. I speak specifically of the make ethical decisions. Before last go around, it was make ethical decisions, you had to have taken the course, so you're deemed as trained. This go around is you not only have to have taken the course, you have to have gone on to the coach.ca site and done the online test, so you then become certified.
Great.
For chaperones, it's having taken the, provided a criminal record check. And Sterling back check is often in play, so then you have to have gone on, and then once you get the record, how can the select few see that the record's been completed and that it's clean, or if it's not clean, that it's sufficiently distanced from what you want the volunteer to do, so you don't want them having to have any record of assault or been in contact with the law for dealing poorly abusively with minors, whether it's maybe they had a speeding ticket or something long ago that has nothing to do with their ability to act positively with youth. And then how is that recorded and how is it kept and so forth? And then how often do you need to get another criminal record check? And it said, just a record check or a vulnerable person sector check.
Yeah, and that's, we cover some of that because the documentation can be very onerous sometimes. Definitely hard to do and it's hard to figure out how to store it. And Peter, over to you. What's your reaction when you hear the documentation?
When I hear the word documentation, I think of it being tedious and often convoluted, but also important for liability reasons and even just for people's general safety, not just my point. But,
a couple of perspectives. Yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
No, that's it. That's all I really have to say. I don't really have too much experience with documentation. But I've seen how drastically people do it in different organizations. Like some people are very meticulous. They'll have like a system where you're just like scanning a URL code and you can just harvest documents like really, really efficiently. And then I have places where they'll just stuff it into a folder in a locked cabinet, or an unlocked cabinet. So
yeah.
And some people take it more seriously than others.
Yeah, and that comes back to you're talking about that word liability, and I think that's also what Spider was trying to, like, that's a big broad word to why you do documentation. And in the first, in Risk Management 101, we talk about you can't get rid of all of the risks. So we learn how to reduce them, to address them, avoid them, or just plain accept them. So you know, the way people handle documentation might also go to how they perceive risk and how to what extent they feel like they need to manage or reduce risk. So it's pretty interesting if you think of it, like you're saying, as a participant, it might be tedious, convoluted, it might be onerous, you might want it to be a lot easier than what it is, but from an organizational perspective, there could be quite a different lens. Thanks for pointing that out, Peter. I think that's really important. So let's jump into a little bit of content. If you haven't had a chance to get into the learning management system, I do have a lot more content in activity number one. So once it's up and running, go ahead and have a look at what is in activity one. I actually did some like sort of audio clips and things like that to explain some of it as well. But what we'll do is we'll start with slide 7 in the presentation slide. So if you have that in front of you, it's the one that says what is risk management. And I use this slide to go through all of the risk management learning events. Just so that we're all clear on what risk management is. So if you look at the underlined words, it's really a process by which we're assessing or evaluating or looking at potential risks. So we have to look for where there's a potential risk and figure out to what extent that is a risk. We need to look at 5 key areas. So you can see here, supervision and instruction is probably an area that both of you are very, very familiar with, as is training, facilities, equipment, emergency response planning. But this one, RM102, zooms in on one of those 5 areas, which is documentation. So that's what we're going to look at. And then the third part of risk management. So we're assessing potential risks. We're looking at them in these 5 key areas. And then we're looking for strategies that, as I mentioned, let us reduce, transfer, which is when we use like things like board and officers' liability insurance or different types of insurances, transfer, avoid, or accept these risks. So those are really key things to know that we never get rid of. we just have different strategies that help us work with the risks that we know might cause us some challenges. So hopefully that slide makes sense. That kind of sets the stage for our conversation. So if you flip to slide 8, slide 8 explains or tries to explain what is documentation. What it is I think this is really important. Documentation is essential because without documentation, there's no proof that what you say you're doing, you're actually doing. So if I don't have a criminal record check in my hand, on paper, as a document, there's no proof that I've actually done it. Now, obviously, we have electronic means, so you might have it emailed to you, so it's electronic, but I think you know sort of what I mean by that. So it's not just like physical paper, it's files and records and things like that, too. So we're going to look at documentation or paperwork this week that you might want to use with your participants. So we'll look at operations next week. So on slide 9, there's a list of 8 different types, and there's also a few samples in there that I sort of pulled together over time. That none of them are really perfect or anything like that, but they're samples, and I believe I emailed that sample file to you today as well. So you can take a look at it if you want to at a later point in time. So if we go to slide 10, slide 10 is about registration.
Sorry, Caroline. Spider here. When I try to open that link on slide 9, it doesn't open. Both what you sent that I'm looking at today and then the previous one on the system, if that helps you.
I'm going to have to update that. So thank you, because I noticed that is an outdated link.
Uh-oh.
What's that?
No, just this 404 not found.
The what?
The link.
Yeah, you know which link is correct? If you hover your cursor over the I for information and get control click, that one will work.
And it's the same thing.
No, they're 2 different links.
Oh. But this is still showing sample of the same content, I mean.
Yeah, it's the same content. It's just a written link. I forgot to update it when I updated it.
We have the GAC on here.
Yeah, so some of those forms are older. So, yeah. Anyways, if we go to registration forms, let's just chat quick. I think what we'll do is we'll just chat about these. What are some of the things that you think you need to collect when you get a registration form? Let's start with you, Peter. What are some examples of things you might collect on a registration form?
Name and emergency contact information and age as well, probably. Usually just to identify if they need to have a parent sign off or not.
Okay, so you might do a registration form different for an adult to a minor?
Yeah. Well, if it's a minor, you basically have to have your parents sign off on it, right? For almost everyone.
Yeah, it depends, right? So, again, that, you know, what are you using this registration form for, right? And what are the purposes of it? What are some other things, Spider, that you might include on a registration form?
I think when I ask them, when I'm asking for ages, I'll put in the they have to put in the year, the month, and the day that they were born. Because often when I'm reporting to subsequently to our funders like MACA, Municipal and Community Affairs Western Canada Lottery Program, then they want to know ages, and it's easiest for me to do a search based on a range of birth dates. Versus then to say, okay, I'm 10. Yeah.
So it makes it quicker, but one of the things that you want to think about is collect only the information that you need. So, you know, some of the sport bilateral funding doesn't need to know the exact age. It might need to know how many kids from the age of 5 to 9 you have and how many from 10 to 12, things like that. So the more personal information you collect, so if you're collecting somebody's name, that's one thing, but when you add a birth date, you add, you know, maybe a phone number, you add a medical number, things like that, now you've just increased what you have to care for that information that you're collecting. Think about what you need it for, right? So if you absolutely need it, for evaluation purposes, for reporting purposes, do that. But the more confidential information you collect on a registration form, the more diligent you'll have to be with how you're storing it. Does that make sense?
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm going to ask you guys, when is an example of when you absolutely would need a birth date? And either of you can jump in.
Basically,
a program, then I still need to know how old they are. I mean, it not necessarily be their birth date, but if I'm running a wrestling program now from the 11 to 17.
Right. So if they're, you can ask them for the year of birth, for example, perhaps for that, right? Which is less confidential than the actual day, month, and year. So that might be an option for that. Peter, you also had an answer to that. What do you think?
Well, I was going to say if it's like a sporting event, like let's say like Arctic Winter Games or something, and there's like a year cutoff for age groups, you kind of need to have their birthday, right?
Exactly. Often the cutoff is in the middle of the year. It's not just the year. Sometimes it can be like March 31st or something like that. So that would be an example of when you do get. With children, say, or youth, when would you not need a birth date? What do you think?
It was all ages.
When you wouldn't need it? Yeah. Like, think of our small communities, our rural communities, right? You're running an after-school program in Tuck, like, or in Pawlatuck, or in Burwash. Is it important to know what age the kids are? Or, like, they're obviously children and youth, right? And there's only so many of them.
Yeah. And so then you wouldn't have to worry about that extra added liability of data breach or whatever.
Yeah, but then your emergency contact might be important. So you got Zilly coming to your program. You don't need a lot of information about Zilly, but maybe you do need to know, are there any allergies, especially food allergies, and who to call in case of an emergency. Do you think you need to collect medical numbers? So that's something that people, you know, typically in the past, we've always asked people for medical numbers, like medical insurance. Spider, what do you think? Is that necessary? Or when
I know that people register for, when they register on Gems Pro for games, they have to put that in. But if it's then on file and they, when they go to the medical center, then, you know, they could look that up and so forth. But generally, I think, if they're from the NWC, then they'll have a medical number and, you know, it's straightforward enough to, I mean, nobody's going to be denied care, and then they'll, you know, if we need to do some legwork on getting that number, then we can do that after the fact.
Exactly. So I agree, like, when you're going to a game or you're traveling, probably should not be collecting those medicines. But you can certainly ask about allergies, especially if you're not the good one. So, just with registration forms, really think through what is the purpose of the form. If you're using it for evaluation, you might include more on it than if you weren't using it for evaluation purposes. So that might be a reason why you're collecting more information. But if you're traveling or you've got somebody like a coach who's responsible for younger people or youth, then that's probably more important to have that information. So just something to think about. So if we go to slide 11, and I think we talked a little bit about this in PM 101, is about photo releases. So really, you're not allowed to use a photo of anyone for any purpose without their permission. So I found at least it's really challenging to get good photos of recreation because of that. Schools in the Yukon collect permission, but that permission doesn't extend to another organization using their photo. And RJ has run into this problem a couple of times. We had a photo shared from Beaver Creek that, and then we're told that a parent was really upset that their child was in the photo, and the person who shared the photo was told that they had permission, but apparently didn't. So, you know, that was one challenge. And then another time, we collected permission to use photos for RJ things. And the photo,
You're breaking up a bit, Caroline.
Yeah, it's a little hard to hear you. You're very faint.
Okay.
Like, really strange.
Okay, maybe I'll take my headset off because sometimes my Bluetooth doesn't work great. So one sec here. Is that any better?
Much better.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, so I find sometimes my head just don't work. I don't know if it's self-service or whatever. Anyways, hopefully that's better. So, yeah, so RPA had another problem where we had permission to use a photo. We had permission to use it for RPA purposes, but actually CDC Yukon went, because our resource was online, took the picture and used it for something else, and it was somebody's wedding photo. And so we got in big trouble for that, and CDC shouldn't have taken the photo without our permission to do so. You have to be really careful with photo releases and how you do that and make sure that you've got permission. If you go to slide number 12, yeah, go ahead.
Sorry, it's so bizarre to me now because, like, the way the world is trending, like, with how everyone has a phone now and people are just always recording other people, usually you will see online, you'll see millions and millions of videos and photos and people taking pictures or videos of other people without their consent, really. And it's just kind of weird that is something that is still, like obviously, I guess if you're an organization, you have to be a lot more careful about it, but it seems like, to me, individuals can just take photos of other individuals and it doesn't really matter, but I don't really know.
Yeah, I mean, it should matter because I believe there's been some cases where, like, photos of other people being used for bullying purposes and things like that, right? So really, we all should be respectful of people's people's wishes around how photos are used and things like that. So, but I think what you're saying too, Peter, is that there's this social norm out there that it's okay to take a picture and share it. And one example is my daughter had a baby, so I'm a grandma as of January, and they've chosen not to have her photos on social media. So we all kind of know that, but there's some people, like even my sister was kind of offended when we said, no, you can't. Like, she put a photo up, and then we was asked to take it down, and she was kind of offended. She didn't understand what the problem was with that, right? So I think, you know, as an organization, we just have to do our due diligence with photos. So trying to be creative and taking people's feet or bicycles or walking poles or dogs, or, well, even dogs might be an issue, but other things, I think.
Did you say that it was a baby that didn't want it, that didn't want the baby on social media or something?
Kaylee had a little girl in January, and so she doesn't want, her name's Channing, she doesn't want Channing's photos on social media. There's a number of reasons. And there's been one of my friends, my sister, and even one of Kaylee's friends, who she'd asked three times not to do it. Like, they just don't think. They stick the photo up there without asking, so.
Yeah. I was just funny because I was thinking, like, my sister has two kids, and I don't think there's a single photo of them on any social media app. And then my brother's wife, she posts, like, thousands of photos of their kids on social media, like, all the time. There's so many photos.
Yeah.
So it's like some people really don't care at all, and some people care a lot. So, yeah,
and I think the long-term repercussions, I have a friend like that. Her kids are now teens, and I could go through her social media and tell you exactly what they were doing throughout their whole entire life. Like, I could write a book about their life. And the thing is they're minors, and they haven't consented to that. And social media and the internet is very bad at getting rid of stuff once it's out there, right? So minors can't consent to things because they're minors. And so I think that we have to be cautious about how we're doing that. So I don't know if that makes sense or not.
No, it does. I was just kind of pointing out the fact that it's weird how, like, that is with the invention of phones. It's just like that whole notion is just normalized, even though it's technically not allowed.
Yeah, it is, and it's definitely something to think about. Like, you know, there's Arctic Winter Games and things coming up, right? So making sure that all those permissions are there, and then if somebody doesn't give permission, you got to make sure you go through all your photos and that they don't appear in the photos. And so it's a challenging piece. And, you know, how long do you keep those photo permission forms for? There's another question, right? So if I'm going to use a photo that's 10 years old, do I still have the signed permission, or do I still have their permission, or would they have maybe taken their permission away because it was 10 years ago and they don't like that photo anymore, right?
Yeah.
Good conversation, though. See, this is the advantage of having a small group. We can do this. So let's go through the other documentation. So on slide 12, it talks about permission to act in an emergency. So because both of you have been involved in sport, I'm sure that you've seen these where it's a consent to provide emergency and or medical care to a minor. So, Spider, I'm guessing that when you guys are traveling or doing sport, or especially for Arctics and other games, you're probably getting this permission to act in an emergency form, right?
If the TSO is strong, Territory Sport Organization is strong, it should have something in place. Sometimes, you know, for example, it's a squash player traveling with Yellowknife Racquet Club Pro. So maybe then we assume that it's under the Racquet Club coverage. But, you know, it makes good sense to double check to make sure that, you know, you're empowered to act in an emergency situation.
Yeah, because, I mean, the assumption is that, yes, you know, if you're a coach, you can go ahead and seek emergency or medical care for a minor who's in your care. Like, that's the assumption. And obviously, if you didn't do it and it was needed, we'd be, you know, people would be saying things. But it's helpful to have it actually written down, because Then there's things that, you know, like might be like the use of an EpiPen or medication or things like that. So it just means that it gives permission for a parent, from a parent, and it's just a helpful form to have if you're traveling. Like, I think mostly if you're traveling, like if the sport's happening in your own community or the program in your own community, you might not need it. But if you're going out on a, you know, 7-day river trip, or you're taking a group out of the territory for a sport event or even a recreation event, probably really helpful to collect this form. So the next one, we've talked about this a little bit, Peter, the medical health screening one. So, you know, I don't know if you want to comment on this one. I've got a picture of the Get Active questionnaire because we used to use the PARQ. So do you want to just share quickly, Peter, when you might use a medical or health screening one?
Sorry, I was muted. Basically, when you're working with people who are a vulnerable population, typically with like pre-existing health issues, or if you're just exercising in general or doing physical activity that can be strenuous, I think like even like just general population, you also obtain health screening, I believe, right? Or is that not correct?
I think it depends on what you're doing, right? What your program is.
Yeah.
Probably working one-on-one with a client in a fitness setting, you probably would want to do a screening. It might look a little different than the Get Active one, or you might just choose to use that one. But I think, as you're pointing out, anybody who's more high risk, right, for having problems or things, you just want to make sure that you know, you're not running into any challenges that might exist. And if you think of the medical health screening, we typically think of, you know, older adults, but it could also be that you're screening for, you know, disabilities or behavioral issues, or even an allergy could be considered like a screening type form. So,
basically anyone I've ever worked with in the context of exercise, which is different from physical activity, I always do a health screening for them.
Exactly, because they're usually your client, right? So you sort of have, that's like your due diligence. That's a good risk management tool.
Yeah, and like you just kind of like, if they have diabetic, if they might have an issue that they don't realize could impede their ability to exercise or cause risk to themselves. So,
right, especially if they're just starting out, so that's great.
Yeah.
So that's a form that you can use.
That diabetes can affect exercise, like, or like that they need to like have like sugar or like whatever. Or I'm just trying to think of some other examples, but like any sort of cardiac condition, basically.
Yeah.
Or like people can get dizzy with exercising and they're not realizing that that is a symptom of like probably a more serious underlying issue. Anyway.
Right. Okay, so let's, sorry, I was just looking at the time there. I can't almost 42 already. No, that's good. So let's take a look. The next three ones are really important, and they'll also lead into our next risk management one. So on slide number 14, or the one that's got header number 5, it talks about informed or parental consent. So something that's really important here is to, and we'll talk about this when we get into RM 103, where we talk about inherent risks and things like that. An informed or parental consent is not a waiver. So we have to remember that it's different to a waiver, because sometimes we use with the word waiver as this really broad sort of term, but a waiver is actually quite specific. So an informed or parental consent, what it does is it raises awareness of those inherent risks. So a risk comes with doing activities that you can't get rid of without either not doing the activity or completely changing it. So if you think about tobogganing, there's a risk of, you know, sliding, falling, hurting yourself, right? If you think of hiking a steep mountain, there's a risk of falling or twisting an ankle, things like that. So those are inherent risks. And sometimes we use, especially if you're doing like a, you know, a high risk activity like a river rafting trip, or an overnight camp or something like that. An informed consent or parental consent is really useful because it lays out what the risks are. And then the person signs it, saying that yes, they understand that these are risks of the activity and they assume these risks. It's not a legal form, so this is not the legal part of it. It is just the part that raises their awareness. And by raising their awareness, if it was ever ended up in a court of law, you could say, well, we informed the person that these are inherent risks. They were aware of it. So just keep in mind it's not the same as a waiver. If you go to the next slide, a waiver is usually the second part. So an informed consent has to be part of a waiver, but it's not the waiver. So the waiver is a release of liability. And this is the, you know, this is involved with transferring risk from the organization to the participant. We will get into waivers in way more detail when we talk about legal risk, but a couple of things that are really important for you to understand here is a waiver may protect an organization in a negligence suit by transferring risk. It doesn't necessarily do that, and the reason why we'll talk about in the next learning event. So you might want to use waivers with high-risk activities or high-risk participants, but you're never going to use a waiver with a minor because nobody, not even a parent or guardian, can waive a minor's rights. And so that's where you will see people using waivers for activities that involve minors, but it wouldn't actually do anything in a court of law. So this is when thinking clearly about what documentation is needed, how much, and for whom is a really important part of using documentation to manage risk. So we'll get into waivers in a lot more. It's a really long conversation, and our next learning event is actually 4 weeks long because of it. So I don't want to go into too much detail right now. On slide 16 or number 7, you can see that safety information in general is a big area of documentation. And it raises risks, whether it's about the activities or about people's use of facilities. A really easy one is ICE. That's, you know, signage or safety information. So this can simply be signs or written information that encourages people to be prepared and raises awareness of the risk. And then on slide 17, I think you're probably both familiar with accident and incident report forms. That help you record the details of something that happened. And it isn't necessarily just a report on a physical injury that somebody sustains. It could be something else that happens. It could be a behavioral incident that happened and you need to record what happened because potentially there's an impact either on you as an organization or on other participants. And so if you're collecting these types of reports, you probably want to keep them on file for 6 to 7 years, just in case you ever end up in a court of law and need to pull it out. So as you can see, that was a longer summary than what I thought, but as you can see from these sort of documentations, there's quite a bit of documentation that relates to participating in recreation. And I just have a couple of questions that I'd like to ask you. And looking at the time, I'm going to jump to my last question first. And really what I'd like to do is I'd like us to talk about how much documentation do we need? Because documentation is a good risk management practice, but it doesn't mean that we want to take all of our programming and time and all of our planning time and everything on documentation. Like we're pretty busy people as recreation leaders, and too much paperwork can be overwhelming for both us and our participants. So, Spider, I'm going to ask you first, and then I'm going to ask you, Peter, second. How much documentation do you think we need to effectively manage risk related to participating in recreation? And that's a really broad question.
Well, I think documentation could be somewhat endless to the participant, depending on how they use the filling it out and whether they ask the same thing again and again. I think it only goes to serve to protect the organization, perhaps protect the individual as well. If you look at ski hills, you know, as you're walking onto ski hills through the gates, it's a huge, you know, you're assuming risk from this point on and so forth. But it's, you know, it's reassuring to have. You know, will it get in the way of people participating? Well, you know, maybe. Maybe it should. Maybe you shouldn't be in the business of, you know, encouraging that much risk. But if it's, it's certainly needed, and we need to get people aware of the risks involved, whether we, you know, transfer them, we assume them, and we buy insurance for them. So I would lean toward, you know, having more documentation than less.
Okay. Are there any types of documentation that you think might be more important than others? Like if we had to make sure we absolutely did one or two types versus other types, which ones do you think we are more common or more frequent or more necessary than other ones?
So certainly the waivers that adults, persons in a majority get enter into. And then the ones we also use are assumptions of risk. And we have make sure that those are done up by lawyers. We were, there was a COVID one recently, but since COVID has been out there for a while, then, our legal representation typically, through sport law, it's called, they talk about how, well, you know, people know a lot about COVID now, so we don't necessarily need a COVID waiver, but we should be still taking, offering opportunities for people to, you know, do the hand sanitizer and wear masks and things like that. Going back to the accident incident report, these often are to inform safety measures that should be developed moving forward. And in fact, if you look at the squash side of it, for example, encouraging people to wear goggles. We can oblige minors to wear them, but we can only encourage adults to wear them.
Right.
And that, but if there's an accident and the insurance comes into play and they have to do a payout or whatever, then they want to make sure, okay, what are you doing now to ensure that, maybe it's a safety goggle signage that you have on the outside of the courts. Maybe you have to certify your coaches so that they're aware that, these are situations on court where, because you're playing, swinging rackets, implements, and applying ball in a confined space, have you told them about situations called lets, where if there's ever a chance you can think you're going to hit your opponent with a racket or the ball, then you hold up and you play let being, let's break, take that over. Ways to get in and out of the court. I do Sunday morning junior squash, and I tell everybody, you knock in, making lots of noise coming in the court, and make lots of noise going out the court, banging your racket against the door. All these to ensure that it's safe, but also to, some push came to shove, that, we could satisfactorily answer that, we offer safety education, and we keep obliging it of them, and we don't just offer it once. We're continually on the lookout to make sure it's a safe place.
Right. So by having a written record of those things, then, because it coming back to what we said at the beginning about documentation is proof that you do what you say you're going to do. So to have anything like that written down as a signage or anything like that is, it's sort of like proving that, this is important and you're not just saying that. So I think that's why documentation is important. Sorry?
If we've had an accident, somebody's been hit in the eye. We had it a couple of seasons ago, and this was a board member and also one of the organizers for Anuvik Squash, and yet they were late, and they raced off, went on to court, forgot their goggles, went on, got hit, and subsequently had to get a couple of operations, which was, so unfortunate and so preventable. And I said, okay, well, do we have the, what do we have in place? And they did have, a box of goggles. And we want to make sure that the goggles are as pristine as possible. And in fact, now for junior programs, we give away the goggles for everybody who enrolls in them. And that, we don't nickel and dime people anymore at the commercial squash center. So if it's at the Anuvik Rec Center, it's a you know, $5 to rent a racket, another $3 for the goggles. Well, I'll just get the racket. No. It's, you know, the goggle rental are free. And in fact, we still encourage the racket rental to be free as well. You know, and what can we do, in our processes to ensure that it's as safe as possible moving forward?
Yeah. And even by having people sign in, you know, like, or sign that they recognize that they need to wear the appropriate safety gear and what that is, or having a little picture, have you donned this, this, and this? So there's different ways to use documentation and signage to reinforce what you're saying in a written or visual format as well. So thanks for that, Spider. Peter, over to you. What are your thoughts on how much documentation do we need to manage risk?
I really liked what Spider said. Like, for some reason, when I was thinking of documentation, I was thinking of, like, only the data that you're collecting from participants. But thinking of, like, procedures and checklists and, like, how you train employees and how you communicate information to participants, like, regarding a certain activity, and, like, having that all well documented is also really important, because it's just showing that you do your due diligence, really. I also liked what he said about removing barriers to safety. So, like, making something like a helmet or goggles, like, a free rental instead of having someone to pay for it, so that they just don't have to, like, think about, is their safety worth whatever $20, a $20 rental, you know? So I really like that. In terms of how much documentation specifically, it seems from, like, what I've learned, at least from this session, is that you want to, it's kind of like a balancing act. Between, you want enough documentation that, like, based on, like, the risk that someone's assuming. So, for example, with the Real Leader program, like, we have a yoga class, and then we also have an archery class. So, an archery class is going to assume a higher level of risk, so you might consider having a bit more documentation. But then at the same time, you want to balance it out with the fact that you don't want to be gathering too much information, because then you are more liable for that data. So it's kind of like
exactly.
A variable thing that you're going to have to be constantly changing depending on the situation.
Yeah. Yeah, you guys both raised some really good points. That the answer usually when anything comes to risk management is it depends. We'll talk about that a lot more with legal risk. It depends on your participants, right? So with high-risk participants, we need more than what with low-risk. And high-risk might be seniors or elders or young children, and or also with high risk activities, you need more than with low risk. So river rafting as compared to yoga perhaps, right? And then also high risk environments. So outdoors in the winter, way higher risk than inside a gym. So those three things, your participants, your location of where you're doing things and the types of activities will also inform the types and how much documentation you need to gather. And I really liked how both of you guys reinforced sort of the use of not just saying that something's important, but also, you know, putting, what is it, what's the saying, putting your money where your mouth is or something like that. So the idea of having helmets or goggles or safety glasses for people to use, but add that with, you know, like a funny sign that, you know, has a cartoony person wearing the three safety gear or the safety gear and arrows pointing there, or add a sign in, like a sign-in sheet that, I picked up my goggles or I have my safety glasses today, check mark, or something like that just to reinforce that. We don't have to do a lot of writing stuff because across the North, sometimes language and paperwork is onerous and plain language is important. So I've added on slide 16, there's a little poster, and it was done by Megan from McClavick last year. And it was simply, you know, a reminder. It raises, you know, the picture's a really good visual of what some of the hazards are, but it's also a reminder of what they can do to prepare to participate. So, I think that it's a really good conversation when we talk about documentation for participation. And yeah, it just depends. So I don't know if that's a good takeaway from the end of a conference call or not, But we've got a minute or two just to wrap up, so I'm just wondering if either of you have any final thoughts on documentation for our participants. Peter, anything to add to that?
No, not really. I think you covered a lot of it already. Obviously, there's more, but I don't really have anything else.
Okay, great. And Spider, any thoughts from your own perspective that we haven't touched on or to add, any reflections?
It's interesting that we're talking about this topic today. I received an email from a guy by the name of Mike Jakubowski, who runs the professional development aspect of the School of Community Government in the NWT. And they're poised to put on a recreation facilities conference coming up November 21 to 23rd. And I open up the agenda, and day two talks about developing policies and procedures that respond to your issues. Well, I'm giving them a call now and saying, Mike, are you going to have a section where we talk about policies and procedures that reduce your risk and increase your safety? And, irregardless of whether it's responding to a facility manager's issues.
Exactly. Yeah, I know Mike because I communicated with him when we were designing the Rec North training program. So it's interesting. They sometimes go a different direction with some of their things. But good question to pose to him. And next week we will be talking about documentation for operations, which includes policies and procedures and things like that, but from a risk management perspective. So,
what I'm also saying is that, we go through the content. We as leaders in recreation need to be aware of opportunities where we can, facilitate those conversations. And this one with the upcoming Recreation Facilities Conference is another one. If we can just get a foot in the door or make sure that those aspects are being talked about, because it'll come down and support us if indeed the training of rec people also gets that, the risk and safety on their radar. And so our work, we're working in concert with other folks. If we can get that as part of their training, a reminder about that risk management and safety, then when we want to put something forward, that maybe we've got another person on our side.
That sounds great. Well, that'll be interesting. So thank you for sharing that, Spider. Thanks for sharing, Peter. What I will do is I